Imagine checking your bank account one morning,
Okay.
and you find your pension is just completely frozen, your hard-earned terminal leave is blocked.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, your assets are just locked down. And then, imagine discovering this wasn't because you were convicted of a
Or
crime.
even formally charged in a courtroom. Right.
Right, not even charged. It's simply because some internal unwritten tag was placed on your file by, like, a middle manager in a government bureaucracy.
I mean, it really sounds like a Kafka novel.
It totally does.
You would assume that for a government agency to essentially seize or freeze your property, there has to be a specific, clearly defined law granting them that exact power.
Right, you'd look for the statute.
Exactly. You'd want to see the law on paper.
Okay, let's unpack this because today we are doing a really rigorous, granular examination of the actual legal limits of the New York City Police Commissioner's disciplinary power.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is.
Yeah.
We are pulling from a highly detailed legal thought piece that analyzes more than a century of legislative history.
Case law, statutory construction.
Yeah, all of it regarding Section 14.115 of the New York City Administrative Code. And for you listening, I mean, this matters tremendously to you, whether you wear a badge or not.
Absolutely.
Because this isn't just some niche academic deep dive into police regulations. This is a masterclass in how government power actually functions.
Or malfunctions in a lot of cases.
Right, malfunctions in everyday life. It really reveals the vital difference between a bureaucracy's internal customs, like the way things have just always been done, and the actual binding letter of the law.
And our mission today is to essentially deconstruct a massive systemic misconception in public employment law.
Which is everywhere, right?
It really is. There is this incredibly pervasive idea out there that because an agency head, in this case, the police commissioner, possesses extraordinarily broad administrative discretion, that discretion somehow equates to unlimited legal jurisdiction.
Like they're the same thing.
Right, but as the source material meticulously points out, those are two profoundly different legal concepts.
Let's start right there, actually, by establishing the baseline. We know, and the source readily acknowledges, that the NYPD commissioner does have vast disciplinary power.
Undeniably.
Right. We're talking about conduct that goes far, far beyond criminal wrongdoing. Like an officer can be disciplined for neglect of duty or violations of department rule.
Absence without leave.
Yeah, immoral conduct. Conduct unbecoming an officer. I mean, that is a massive umbrella.
It is a massive umbrella, and deliberately so. I mean, police officers exercise coercive governmental power, you know, they can arrest, detain, use force.
So they need tight leashes.
Exactly. Therefore, they operate in a highly regulated, hierarchical institution that requires really strict internal discipline. The legislature recognized this.
Of course.
But the core threshold distinction our source draws is the difference between executive administrative discretion and subject matter jurisdiction.
I want to translate that because subject matter jurisdiction sounds like something you just sleep through in a 1L civil procedure class.
It can be a little dry.
Let me offer an analogy to make this really concrete for you listening. Think about it like having a company credit card.
Okay.
Discretion is getting to choose which hotel you book for a business trip. Do you stay at the Marriott or do you stay at the Hilton?
Right.
Do you fly Delta or United? That is your managerial discretion. Jurisdiction, on the other hand, is the strict, legally binding list of categories you are allowed to spend money on at all.
That's a great way to frame it.
Having wide discretion to pick a hotel does not give you the jurisdiction to walk into a dealership and buy a sports car on the corporate card.
The analogy holds up really well. I mean, you have wide latitude within authorized statutory alternatives, but you have zero authority to create an entirely new alternative outside that statutory grant.
So the commissioner has options, but only from a pre-approved menu.
Exactly. The commissioner can decide within lawful bounds whether a specific act of misconduct warrants, say, a minor reprimand or a total dismissal.
They have discretion over the severity.
Right, the severity of the sanction.
Yeah.
But they absolutely cannot invent entirely new forms of financial attachment or institute post-employment punishments just because it advances some internal disciplinary goal.
But wait. Practically speaking, if someone is the absolute head of an agency, isn't their directive essentially the law of the agency?
People certainly treat it that way.
We hear this phrase constantly in bureaucratic environments, right? People say, well, the PC's office authorized it, or the commissioner signed off. People treat that as the ultimate trump card.
They do, and that is precisely the danger here. The source completely deconstructs this reliance on executive approval.
How so?
It explains that this internal institutional sign-off, it only identifies the decision maker. It completely fails to identify the legal source of the authority empowering them to make that decision in the first place.
Wow.
Yeah, an agency head doesn't become the source of the law just by sitting at the top of the organizational chart.
So the commissioner's signature just means the boss said to do this. But it doesn't answer the actual legal question, which is, did the boss actually have the legal right to say this?
That captures the legal reality perfectly. In a highly regulated command and control institution like the NYPD, managerial power and disciplinary power are fused into the exact same office.
Right. It's the same person.
So when the commissioner issues a directive, the sheer weight of that institutional authority makes an internal determination feel self-validating.
It feels like an actual law to the people working there.
But it isn't. The broad scope of the commissioner's authority presupposes a lawful statutory power. It does not create a self-generating executive jurisdiction.
Okay, so to figure out exactly what is on that approved list of categories, to go back to our corporate credit card analogy, we have to move past the internal jargon, right?
We have to look directly at the precise machinery of the statute that grants this power.
Which brings us to the statutory deconstruction of New York City Administrative Code, Section 14.115. Let's really look under the hood of how this law operates.
Section 14.115 is essentially the engine of NYPD disciplinary authority. Let's start with subdivision A.
Okay.
This is what legal scholars call the adjudicative predicate.
The adjudicative predicate.
Right. The statute explicitly states that discipline hinges on the phrase on conviction.
On conviction, not on accusation.
Exactly. It does not say on allegation. It does not say upon commencement of an internal affairs investigation, or whenever the department decides to maintain an open case.
But come on, if an officer is accused of something horrific, say, I don't know, severe corruption, and the investigative file is an inch thick, you can't expect the commissioner to just shrug their shoulders.
Sure.
Even without a formal conviction, there has to be some mechanism to act, right?
There is a mechanism for temporary action, which we'll get to later. But for permanent disciplinary penalties like seizing salary or enforcing forfeitures, the law requires a legal transformation.
What do you mean by a legal transformation?
Legally, until there is an adjudication, an investigation file is just a collection of accusations. An investigation only determines whether the department believes misconduct occurred.
Got it.
A disciplinary adjudication, however, determines that the accusation has been formally established through due process. Section 14.115 requires a conviction.
So punishment must follow the legal event that transforms an accusation into sustained misconduct.
Precisely.
Because if an employee suffers an economic consequence like losing pay or having their pension frozen just because an investigation is quote-unquote open, the unresolved status itself has basically become the predicate for punishment.
Which flies in the face of the words on conviction. What's fascinating here is the sheer architecture of the text.
Mm.
The legislature didn't just write a general mission statement like, the commissioner shall maintain discipline by any means necessary.
They didn't leave it vague?
Not at all. They built a highly specific, constrained disciplinary engine. After requiring a conviction, the statute doesn't just say punish them however you see fit. It specifically enumerates the authorized punishments.
Right. The list is very clear. It's reprimand, forfeiture, and withholding of pay for a specified time, suspension without pay, and dismissal from the force.
And this brings in a fundamental bedrock doctrine of statutory construction. It's a Latin phrase, expressio unius est exclusio alterius.
Okay, we'll leave that on us.
Simply translated, the expression of one thing implies the exclusion of others.
The expression of one thing implies the exclusion of others.
Because the legislature took the deliberate time to specifically list those exact sanctions, that specific list legally bars the NYPD from creating non-enumerated extra statutory penalties.
I want to break that down for someone who isn't, you know, an appellate attorney. You're basically saying that if a parent tells a teenager, you can have an apple, a banana, or an orange for a snack, the parent doesn't need to explicitly say you cannot have a chocolate cake.
That's a perfect way to put it.
The act of listing the specific fruits legally excludes the cake.
That's the exact mechanic. If the legislature wanted the commissioner to have the power to create indefinite financial holds, or seize post-retirement benefits, or invent new forms of financial attachment, they would have written it into that list.
They would have added the cake to the menu.
Exactly. Their silence is a binding legal limitation, not an invitation for the agency to just get creative.
Let's look at the express 30-day salary ceiling. within that same subdivision, because the mathematical reality here is pretty stunning.
It really is.
The law explicitly says, and I'm quoting the source here, no more than 30 days' salary shall be forfeited or deducted for any offense.
This is a critical restraint. The legislature didn't just grant power, it actively restrained it in the exact same sentence.
They built the brakes right into the engine.
Exactly. It didn't leave the financial penalty to the sound discretion of the commissioner. It drew a hard numerical line. 30 days, not 31, not 60.
And what happens to that forfeited money? Because this was a detail in the source that completely changed how I view this entire process.
Yeah, this is key.
The statute dictates that these exact forfeitures must be transferred directly into the police pension fund.
The destination of the funds is an incredibly vital detail. By specifying exactly where the money goes, the legislature proved that forfeiture under this statute is a defined, finalized legal event.
It's a permanent transfer of capital.
It is. It's not some informal authority to hold someone's money in an accounting limbo like an escrow account until the department decides what to do with it.
Right.
If the agency bypasses these rules and just holds compensation indefinitely without a conviction, they are completely disrupting the pension and payroll ecosystem outlined in the statute.
Okay, so that's the punishment side, the teeth of the statute. Let's look at the procedural protections, which are in Subdivision B.
Right, the procedural safeguards.
The law requires written charges, reasonable notice, an examination, and a hearing before trial commissioners.
It confirms that formal discipline operates through an adjudicative mechanism, not just executive fiat. You can't bypass written charges and notice just because it's administratively convenient.
You have to do the paperwork. You have to have the hearing.
Right. And the statute goes even further to restrict implied powers in Subdivision C, which is the dedicated withholding provision.
This part explicitly outlines when pay can be withheld for absence, lost time, or sickness. And the source argues that this precision entirely negates the idea that the commissioner has some implied or residual power to withhold pay for other unlisted reasons.
If we look at how statutory interpretation actually works, that argument is airtight.
Why is that?
Well, if the legislature took the time to write down exact, specific rules for withholding pay just because an officer is out sick or misses a shift, why would they leave a giant unwritten loophole for the commissioner to unilaterally freeze pay for complex disciplinary investigations without following any rules?
They wouldn't.
They wouldn't.
Yep.
The presence of specific withholding rules destroys the argument for implied withholding rules.
And even Subdivision D, which deals with probationary limits, operates the exact same way.
Yeah.
It dictates that guilt is a strict prerequisite to probation, and it caps that probationary period at 1 year.
Every single subdivision performs specific legal work. The statute is a meticulously engineered machine.
And this incredibly precise, structured set of rules didn't just appear out of thin air in a modern draft, right? It is the result of over a century of deliberate, continuous legislative choices.
It has a very long lineage.
Which brings us to the legislative history of this statute. I love this part because it proves this isn't just a typo or some forgotten law from the horse and buggy days that nobody noticed.
To really understand the modern statute, we have to trace its origins all the way back to the Greater New York Charter, specifically Section 302, right around the 1897 and 1901 consolidation of the city.
Wow, so over 100 years ago.
Over 100 years ago. Mm. That is the substantive ancestry of the disciplinary power. Then, as the city modernized, you have the 1937 Administrative Code recodification, where this became former Section 434A 14.0.
But lawmakers didn't just set it in 1937 and forget about it.
Yeah.
They were constantly opening up the hood and tweaking this machine.
Very actively.
The source details legislative amendments in 1940, specifically addressing salary deductions, and then again in 1955 and in 1962 addressing procedural rules.
And that continuous legislative oversight is the smoking gun for enforcing statutory limits. Think about the implications of that. Lawmakers actively reviewed the statute over multiple decades.
They were paying attention.
Very close attention. When they wanted to address how salary withholding worked, they defined it. When they wanted to refine disciplinary procedures, they defined them.
Right.
They repeatedly returned to the framework, but they deliberately, consciously retained the statutory limits on punishment, like the 30-day cap and the enumeration of penalties.
So if the legislature kept opening up the statute to tweak it in 1940, 1955, and 1962, but explicitly left the strict financial limits in place, that legally proves the omission of broader powers wasn't an accident.
Not an accident at all.
It was a deliberate choice to constrain the commissioner.
Exactly. The statutory pattern is one of careful specification, not some sweeping inherent power. The power is broad because the legislature made it broad, and its boundaries are enforceable for the exact same reason.
And this carried forward.
Yes, this continuity carried right through the 1985 recodification, which gave us the current numbering of Section 14.115.
Now, if I'm playing devil's advocate for the city, I know they often point to the historical independence of the NYTD to claim that commissioner has this expansive inherent power that just supersedes normal rules.
They do make that argument.
They'll cite major appellate cases like Matter of Montella v. Bratton from 1999 and Matter of Elias v. Kelly from 2008.
Those cases are structurally crucial, yes. But the city's reliance on them to claim unlimited power is a massive misreading.
How so? What did those cases actually say?
What Montellin and Elias established is that NYPD discipline is an independent, comprehensive statutory system. It doesn't derive from general state civil service laws, like Civil Service Law Section 75.
So the NYPD doesn't have to follow the general civil service rules for discipline.
Correct. The NYPD has its own bespoke legislative regime.
It's a special carve-out.
It is a carve-out. But the city can't cherry-pick the benefits of that carve-out while totally ignoring its restrictions.
You can't have your cake and eat it, too.
Exactly. The very same legislative history that grants the NYPD its independent, insulated authority also strictly preserves the limitations on that authority. Renumbering a statute in 1985 didn't magically transform enumerated powers into an unrestricted executive prerogative.
Right.
You are bounded strictly by your own legislative terms.
And it isn't just abstract legal theory that these boundaries are meant to hold firm. For decades, the courts have actively, sometimes aggressively, slapped down attempts by the commissioner to cross these very lines.
We have a long paper trail of this.
Let's dig into the comprehensive case law audit provided in the source material, because this is where we see what happens when the unstoppable force of the NYPD meets the immovable object of the courts.
The courts have been remarkably historically consistent in enforcing these statutory boundaries against executive overreach. Let's look closely at Murphy v. Murphy.
Okay, Murphy v. Murphy.
This was decided by the First Department in 1975 and affirmed by the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, in 1976. In this case, the police commissioner formally found an officer guilty of misconduct and imposed a penalty that included a fine of 90 days' pay.
But wait, we just went over the text of the statute. The statute explicitly caps punitive forfeiture at 30 days per offense. Did the commissioner just think the court wouldn't notice?
The argument often relies on an appeal to broad discretion, the idea that severe misconduct warrants severe penalties, and the commissioner should have the flexibility to impose them regardless of the strict number.
But the court didn't buy that.
No, they directly invalidated that 90-day pay fine and reduced it to the statutory maximum of 30 days. The court's rationale was clear. The commissioner unquestionably had the jurisdiction to discipline the officer, but they selected a financial punishment that exceeded the mathematical authority conferred by the statute.
So the commissioner's broad discretion simply didn't matter in the face of a hard legislative number. Broad discretion does not permit 90 days when the legislature authorizes no more than 30.
Precisely. Discretion operates within the jurisdiction. It cannot expand it. Then there's Foran v. Murphy from 1973.
What happened there?
This case basically confirms the two-sided coin of the NYPD's special disciplinary rules. It confirmed that while special police disciplinary provisions exceed general civil service law, they remain strictly governed by their own internal ceilings.
Ah, so again, you get the benefit of the broader police-specific regime, but you are still trapped by the boundaries of that same regime.
Exactly. You are bound by the walls of your own house.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The temporal boundary. It's one thing to argue over money, but what about time? The source highlights Bud v. Valentine from 1940. This deals with the statutory one-year probation limit.
This is a brilliant illustration of jurisdiction. In Bud, an officer was placed on probation. The statute at the time, just like today, capped probationary discipline at 1 year.
So imagine being that officer. You've been placed on probation, you count the days, the one-year mark hits, you think you are clear, you breathe a massive sigh of relief.
You think it's over.
And then, 13 months and 3 days after your probation started, the commissioner decides to dismiss you anyway, relying on the fact that you were on probation.
And the city likely argued that a delay of a few weeks or a month shouldn't strip the commissioner of the power to fire a problematic officer.
Just a little administrative delay, no big deal.
Right. But the Court of Appeals stepped in and completely voided the dismissal. They held that the statutory one-year limit on probation was jurisdictional, not just a procedural suggestion or a general guideline.
So the commissioner's authority existed for the exact 365-day period the statute authorized. Once the clock struck midnight on that final day, the power evaporated into thin air.
Completely evaporated. You cannot extend statutory power through administrative practice or bureaucratic delay. It highlights the rigid mathematical reality of jurisdiction.
It's a hard stop.
Very hard. Yeah. And finally, in this historical audit, we have Dubin v. City of New York from 1941. In this case, the court ruled that simply being the executive head of the department acting in your general capacity as the commissioner confers zero inherent salary withholding authority outside what the statute explicitly says.
Let me synthesize this because the pattern is striking. Across completely different decades, 1940, 1941, 1973, 1975, and addressing completely different types of overreach financial caps in Murphy, temporal limits in Budd, generalized administrative power in Dubin's, the highest courts in the state have held a single unified line.
And what is that line?
Broad executive discretion does not permit exceeding granted legislative authority.
That is the immovable rule. Executive approval cannot substitute for statutory authority.
Okay, but all of those cases deal with what happens after an adjudication, or at least during a formal disciplinary process like probation. What happens in that murky, undefined period before a conviction?
That's where things get really messy.
Because earlier, I asked how the department handles an officer accused of severe misconduct while the investigation is ongoing. The source spends a massive amount of time contrasting legitimate pre-adjudication authority with extra legal holds.
This brings us to a vital companion statute, which is New York City Administrative Code Section 14123. The legislature did not ignore the practical reality that officers facing serious, credible allegations might need to be sidelined while an investigation or trial happens.
They didn't leave the agency completely helpless.
No, they didn't.
Right, they wrote a specific rule for it. Section 14.123 allows the commissioner to suspend a member without pay pending the trial of charges. But here is the kicker, and it's a massive protection. The statute mandates back pay restoration upon acquittal. If you aren't convicted, you get your withheld money back. This was affirmed in the 1961 case, Brenner v. City of New York.
This raises an important question. If the law explicitly allows suspension pending trial under Section 14-923, complete with a strict triggering event pending trial of charges and a mandatory restoration rule upon acquittal, what are we to make of unwritten internal practices like IAB holds, open cases, or pending clearance tags?
The source calls them out directly as a myth, or at least a legal fiction. In reality, they operate as indefinite extra statutory prejudgments.
Yes, they do.
Unlike Section 14.123, which is an actual law passed by elected officials, an IAB hold has no statutory maximum duration, no adjudicative standard of proof, and absolutely no restoration rule. It's just a tag in an internal affairs computer system.
Let's explore how dangerous that is. An IAB hold just identifies that internal affairs hasn't closed an investigation. That's an administrative workflow fact. But investigative authority and forfeiture authority are not legally interchangeable. How does an internal workflow tag magically transform into the affirmative legal authority to freeze someone's pension, their terminal leave, or their accumulated compensation?
It doesn't.
Exactly, it doesn't. Because if the legislature knew exactly how to authorize pre-adjudication economic consequences, which we know for a fact they did because they wrote Section 14-123 to handle suspensions, the fact that they did not authorize IAB holds to seize property means those holds have no legal force to do so.
Let's play out the hypothetical. Say Officer Smith has an open case regarding a procedural violation from 3 years ago. The department hasn't brought formal charges. They haven't suspended him under 14.123. They just left the file open.
A very common scenario, sadly.
And they use that open status to freeze his assets.
If we extrapolate how this plays out in practice, it is a profound violation of the separation of powers. By doing what you just described, the NYPD is effectively creating its own triggering condition and its own remedial power.
Because they control the investigation timeline.
Exactly. So they can keep it open as long as they want. By doing so, they control the duration of the economic deprivation, all without ever having to prove the underlying accusation in an adjudicative setting. They are playing both the legislature that writes the law and the judge that enforces it.
And this gets even more complex and adversarial when an officer is separating from the department. The source dives heavily into post-separation jurisdiction, specifically regarding retirement.
Retirement is a huge flashpoint for this.
Right. Does the act of filing for retirement suddenly give the commissioner new emergency powers to freeze assets?
No, it does not. Retirement certainly changes the practical timing of discipline. If an officer leaves, you obviously can't fire them anymore.
Right.
But retirement absolutely does not enlarge the substantive authority granted by Section 14.115. A reduction in the department's disciplinary leverage because an employee is walking out the door doesn't magically manifest a new legal power to seize earned property like terminal leave, accrued vacation time, or variable supplements fund VSF payments.
Because those financial interests arise from completely different statutory, contractual, or regulatory frameworks. They aren't governed by the disciplinary rules of Section 14.115.
Correct.
But wait, I know the city's lawyers point to a specific case here. What about matter of Gratano v. Kennedy from 1959? Doesn't the city use that to justify holding things up at retirement?
They attempt to, but the source meticulously clarifies why that is a massive misapplication of the precedent. Gratano only addresses the scheduling of hearings before retirement.
Just the scheduling.
The court reasonably recognized that a disciplinary tribunal could take an appropriate retirement date into account when rushing to schedule a hearing because retirement affects the practical efficacy of the process.
Meaning, we better have this trial tomorrow because he retires on Friday.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But Gratano absolutely did not hold that the prospect of retirement permits the department to preserve loss leverage by converting unrelated economic interests like terminal leave into collateral for unresolved allegations. The power to expedite a hearing is not the power to seize a pension without one.
So if an officer is staring at a frozen pension or blocked terminal leave because of a phantom IAB hold, what is their actual recourse? They can't just write a strongly worded letter to human resources.
No, that won't get you far.
There's a specific legal sequence they have to trigger, right? This brings us to the order of review, enforcement, and civil rights.
This is where government lawyers often make a massive fundamental misstep in court. When a member sues the department, the city's attorneys frequently jump straight to arguing for administrative deference under a famous 1974 case called Matter of Pell v. Board of Education.
Let's translate Pell deference for a second because it's a huge deal in administrative law. The government's argument is usually, hey, judge, our internal policy to freeze this asset is rational. It makes sense for managing a police force. It's not arbitrary or capricious. Therefore, court, you must defer to our managerial judgment.
That is the standard defense, and it is true that courts do accord substantial deference to administrative determinations. They don't want to micromanage the daily operations of a police department.
Which makes sense.
Right, but that entire deference framework presupposes the existence of lawful administrative authority. The threshold question, the ultravirus review, must happen before you ever get to Pell deference.
Ultravirus.
Yes. Ultravirus literally translates to beyond the powers. The court first has to ask, did the agency have the legal jurisdiction to take this action in the first place?
You can't ask a judge to defer to a power that doesn't exist on paper.
That is the crux of the argument. Deference regulates judicial review of lawful power. It does not create the power being reviewed. You cannot bootstrap jurisdiction out of deference.
Are there cases that prove this outside of just the police department?
Oh, absolutely. The source points to vital cases outside the police context to prove this is a universal rule of administrative law. Look at Vink v. NYS DHCR from 2001 and Greater New York Taxi as in v. NYC TLC from 2014.
Oh, what do they say?
These cases cement the rule that agencies cannot engraft additional requirements or assume additional powers not explicitly contained in their enabling legislation.
And if the agency tries to invent post hoc rationalizations in court to justify their actions, like, oh, we didn't actually freeze this asset under Section 14.115. We did it under this other vague generalized managerial power over accounting the courts reject that bait and switch too, right?
Yes. Under a landmark case called Matter of Sherbin from 1991, judicial review of an administrative determination is strictly limited to the grounds actually invoked by the agency at the time the action was taken.
Oh, that's huge.
It is. You cannot invent a materially different legal justification once the member hauls you into court and you realize your original reasoning was flawed. If the internal record says the economic deprivation was due to an IAB hold, the agency has to prove to the judge what specific statute makes an IAB hold a valid vehicle for property seizure.
And as we've established, no such statute exists.
None.
So what does this all mean for the person actually fighting this? How do they force the agency's hand?
Well, the legislature actually built a lawsuit mechanism directly into the administrative code itself.
Yes, they did. Section 14.116. Explicitly provides a 2-year limitations period for current or former members to sue to recover unlawfully withheld salary, pay, money, or compensation.
The presence of that statute is incredibly revealing. It proves that the legislature fully expected members to challenge the department when it overstepped its bounds. It anticipated judicial proceedings to recover assets.
What does that lawsuit actually look like in New York?
In New York, the standard legal vehicle for this is an Article 78 proceeding. It's the specific mechanism you use to sue the government, specifically to challenge an action taken by a state or local agency that was taken outside of their jurisdiction, or to demand the annulment of an unauthorized administrative hold.
But there is another massive layer here beyond just getting your money back, right? Civil rights independence. Because a disciplinary action can be statutorily authorized on paper, but independently unlawful in execution.
This is a crucial distinction that often gets muddled. Section 14.115 determines the scope of police disciplinary authority, but it does not provide an impenetrable shield of immunity from civil rights laws like Title VII, 42 U.S.C., Section 1983, the New York State Human Rights Law, or the New York City Human Rights Law.
So let me get this straight.
Yeah.
The commissioner could fire someone following all the rules of 14.115. They get a conviction. They give written notice. They hold a hearing. They don't exceed the penalty limit.
Everything by the book.
Right. But if they only chose to target that specific officer because of their race, gender, or as retaliation for whistleblowing, it's still an illegal act.
Yes. A disciplinary action might follow the exact letter of Section 14.115, but if it is applied in a discriminatory or retaliatory manner, it violates civil rights laws independently.
And conversely, an action can be ultra vires completely without statutory power, even if there is zero discriminatory motive at play. You don't have to prove your supervisor hated you or discriminated against you. You just have to prove they didn't have the mathematical legal authority to take your money.
The enforcement analysis requires careful separation of these legal theories. An ultra vires claim asks a simple structural question. Did they have the statutory authority?
Right.
A due process claim asks, did they use constitutionally adequate procedures? An equal protection or civil rights claim asks, was this penalty administered because of a protected status? Section 14.115 does not collapse all of these into a single question. They are independent vectors of accountability.
Pulling all these complex threads together, what we see in this rigorous source text is a century-long high-stakes tug-of-war between relentless institutional momentum and strict statutory boundaries. The core message for you listening is this. The police commissioner's power is legislative in origin, it is legislatively structured, and it is judicially bounded.
They may vigorously administer the disciplinary authority the legislature actually enacted, but they absolutely may not enlarge that authority through administrative practice, internal nomenclature like IAB holds, or executive approval.
No matter how many times they sign off on it.
Right. Repetition of a policy over decades does not legally amend the administrative code. An agency's custom does not overwrite the law.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought to chew on. Think back to our opening metaphor about the company credit card and the boundaries of jurisdiction. If the NYPD, the very institution whose entire fundamental existence is predicated on enforcing the strict, absolute letter of the law, can internally normalize practices that exceed their own legal boundaries for decades,
right,
simply through bureaucratic momentum and internal jargon.
It makes you wonder.
It does. What does that reveal about the nature of unchecked administrative state power as a whole?
It's a staggering thought. If it happens in an agency under this much public scrutiny, where else is it happening?
It really is. Are there other local or federal agencies in your daily life, zoning boards, tax authorities, professional licensing agencies, operating on custom institutional momentum and internal workflows rather than actual past statutory authority? Because as we've learned today, just because the government has always done it that way doesn't mean they actually have the power to do it. Thank you so much for joining us in unpacking these sources today. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.